Sean eased open the action of the double-barreled Gibbs, without allowing the side lock to click. He slid the brass-cased cartridges out of the breeches, and replaced them with two others from the leather ammunition pouch beneath his monkey-skin cape. The .577 cartridges were thicker than a man's thumb, and the clumsy, blunt-nosed bullet heads were jacketed in copper and capped with soft blue lead, so they could mushroom through living tissue, tearing open a wide channel and inflicting terrible damage. This little ritual of changing his cartridges was one of Sean's superstitions. He always did it just before he closed with dangerous game. He closed the rifle as gently and silently as he had opened it and glanced back at the two men behind him. The whites of Alistair's eyes gleamed in his blackened face. He carried the Bren gun. Sean had not been able to wean him from it. Despite its unwieldy long barrel and great weight, Alistair loved the automatic weapon. "When I'm after Mickey Mouse, I like to be able to turn the air blue with lead," he explained with that lazy grin. "Nobody's going to get a chance to stuff my knackers down my throat, matey." At the rear, Ray Harris gave Sean the thumbs-up signal, but the sweat and rain had cut pale runnels through the soot and fat on his face, and even through the camouflage, Sean could see how haggard he was with fear and fatigue. "The old man's getting past it," Sean thought dispassionately. "Have to put him out to grass soon." Ray carried the Sterling submachine gun. Sean suspected it was because he could no longer manage the weight of a more substantial weapon. "In the bamboo, it's point blank," Ray excused his choice. And Sean had not bothered to argue or to point out that the tiny 9mm bullets would be deflected by the frailest twig and smothered in the dense vegetation of the Aberdares, while the big .600 grain slug from his own Gibbs would plough straight through branch and stem and still blow the guts out of the Mickey Mouse on the other side, while the stubby 20-inch barrels were perfect for close work in the bamboo, and he could swing them without risking hooking up in the brush. Sean clicked his tongue softly, and Motatu went away on the spur in that soft-footed, ungainly lope, which he could keep up day and night without tiring. They crossed another heavily bambooed ridge, and in the valley beyond, Motatu stopped again. It was so dark by now that Sean had to move up beside him and go down on one knee to examine the sign. It took him almost a minute to make sense of it, even after Motatu had pointed out the other set of tracks coming in from the right. Sean gestured Ray to move up and laid his lips to his ear. "They've joined another party of Mickey Mice. Probably from the base camp. 8 of them. 3 women. So we have 13 in a bunch now. A lovely, lucky number." But as he spoke, the light was going, and the rain started again, spilling softly out of the purple-black sky. Within 500 yards, Motatu stopped for the last time, and Sean could just make out the pale palm of his right hand as he made the washout signal. Night had blanketed the spur. The white men each found a tree trunk to prop themselves against, spreading out in a defensive circle facing outwards. Sean took Motatu under the monkey-skin cloak with him, as though he were a tired gun dog. The little man's skinny body was as cold and wet as a trout taken from a mountain stream, and he smelled of herbs and leaf mould and wild things. They ate the hard-salted dry buffalo meat and cold maize cakes from their belt pouches and slept fitfully in each other's warmth, while the raindrops pattered down on the fur over their heads. Motatu touched Sean's cheek, and he was instantly awake in the utter darkness. Slipping the safety catch of the Gibbs that lay across his lap, he sat rigid, listening and alert. Beside him, Motatu snuffled the air, and after a moment Sean did the same.
"Wood smoke," he whispered,
and both of them came to their feet. In the darkness, Sean moved to where Alistair and Ray were lying and got them up. They went forward in the night, holding the belt of the man ahead to keep in contact. The whiffs of smoke were intermittent, but stronger. It took almost 2 hours for Motatu to locate the Mau Mau encampment precisely, using his sense of smell and hearing, and at the end, the faint glow of a patch of campfire coals. Although the bamboo dripped all around, they could hear them. A soft cough, a strangled snore, the gabble of a woman in a nightmare. And Sean and Motatu moved them into position. It took another hour, but in the utter darkness before the true dawn, Alistair was lying up the slope, 40 feet from the dying campfire. Raymond was amongst the rocks on the bank of the stream on the far side, and Sean lay with Mutatu in the dense scrub beside the path that led into the camp. Sean had the barrel of the Gibbs across his left forearm, and his right hand on the pistol grip with the safety catch under his thumb. He had spread the fur cloak over both himself and Mutatu, but neither of them even drowsed. They were keyed up to the finest pitch. Sean could feel the little Ndorobo trembling with eagerness where their bodies touched. He was like a bird dog with the scent of the grouse in his nostrils. The dawn came stealthily. First, Sean realized that he could see his own hand on the rifle in front of his face, and then the short, thick barrels appeared before his eyes. He looked beyond them and made out a tendril of smoke from the fire rising out of the Stygian forest towards the lighter pitch of darkness that was the sky through the canopy of bamboo. The light came on more swiftly, and he saw that there were two crude shelters, one on each side of the fire, low lean-tos, not more than waist high, and he thought he saw a movement in one of them, perhaps a recumbent figure, rolling over and pulling up a skin blanket over his head. Again somebody coughed, a thick, phlegmy sound. The camp was waking. Sean glanced up the slope, and then down into the stream bed. He could see the soft sheen of the water-polished boulders, but nothing of the other two hunters. The light hardened again. Sean closed his eyes for a moment, and then opened them again. He could see sharply the support of the roof of the nearest shelter, and dimly beyond it, a human shape wrapped in a fur blanket. Shooting light in 2 minutes, he thought. The others would know it also. All three of them had waited like this in countless dawns, beside the rotting carcass of pig or antelope, for the leopard to come to the bait. They could judge that magical moment when the sights were crisp enough to make the sure killing shot. This dawn, they would wait for Sean before they came in with the Bren and the Stirling. Again, Sean closed his eyes, and when he opened them again, the figure in the nearest shelter was sitting up and looking towards him. For a gut-swooping instant, he thought he had been spotted, and he almost fired. Then he checked himself as the head turned away from him. Abruptly, the figure threw the fur blanket aside and stood up, crouching under the low roof of the shelter. Sean saw it was a woman, one of the Mau Mau camp followers, but for Sean just as cruel and depraved as any of her menfolk. She stepped out into the open beside the dead fire, wearing only a short kilt of some pale material. Her breasts were high and pointed, and her skin smooth and glossy as newly mined anthracite in the soft dawn light. She came directly towards where Sean lay, and though her gait was still clumsy and unsteady with sleep, he saw that she was young and comely. A few more paces and she would stumble over him, but then she stopped again and yawned, and her teeth were very white, gleaming in the soft grey light. She lifted her kilt around her waist and squatted facing Sean, spreading her knees and bowing her head slightly to watch herself as she began to urinate. Her water splashed noisily, and the sharp, ammoniacal tang of it made Sean's nostrils flare. She was so close that he did not have to lift the Gibbs to his shoulder. He shot her in the stomach. The heavy rifle bounded in his grip, and the bullet picked the girl up, and while she was in the air it broke her in half, blowing a hole through her spine into which her own head would have fitted, and she folded up, loose and floppy, as a suit of discarded clothing, as she fell back onto the muddy forest floor. Sean fired the second barrel as one of the other Mau Mau bolted out of the nearest shelter. The Gibbs made a sound like the slamming of a great steel door, and the man was hurled back into the shelter with half his chest torn away. Sean had two more cartridges held between the fingers of his left hand, and as he opened the breech of the Gibbs, the spent brass cases pinged away over his shoulders, and he slid the fresh cartridges into the empty breeches and closed the rifle again in the same movement. The Bren and the Stirling were firing now. Their muzzle flashes were bright and pretty as fairy lights in the gloom, twinkling and sparkling, and the bullets went flip, flip, flip amongst the leaves and sang shrilly as they ricocheted into the forest. Sean shot again, and the Gibbs cannoned down another naked figure, knocking him flat against the soft earth, as though he had been run down by a locomotive. And again he shot, but this one was a snapshot, and the Mau Mau jinked just as the Gibbs thundered. The bullet hit him in the shoulder joint and blew his right arm off, so it hung by a tatter of torn flesh, and flapped against his side as he spun round. Raymond Sterling buzzed and cut him down. Sean reloaded and shot left and right, clean kills with each barrel, and by the time he had reloaded again, the camp was silent, and the Bren and the Sterling had ceased firing. Nothing moved. All three men were deadly natural shots, and the range was point blank. Sean waited a full 5 minutes. Only a fool walked directly up to dangerous game, no matter how dead it appeared to be. Then he rose cautiously to his knees, with the rifle at high port across his chest. The last Mau Mau broke. He had been feigning dead in the far shelter, and he had judged his moment finely, waiting until the attackers relaxed and began to move. He flushed like a jackrabbit and shot into the bamboo on the far side of the clearing. Alistair's Bren was blanketed by the wall of the nearest shelter, but he fired nevertheless, and the bullets futilely thrashed the hut. From the river bank, Ray had a clearer shot, but he was a fraction of a second slow. The cold had brought out the malaria in his blood, and his hand shook. The bamboo absorbed the light 9mm bullets, as though he had fired into a haystack. For the first 10 paces, the running Mau Mau was screened from Sean's view by the wall of the nearest hut, and then Sean caught only a flickering glimpse of him as he dived into the bamboo. But already Sean was on him, swinging the stubby double barrels as though he were taking a right-hand passing shot on a driven Francolin. Although he could no longer see his quarry in the dense bamboo, he continued his swing on the line of the man's run, instinctively leading him. The Gibbs gave its angry bellow, and red flame blazed from the muzzle. The huge bullet smashed into the wall of bamboo, and at Sean's side Matatu shouted gleefully, "Piga! Hit!" as he heard the bullet tell distinctively on living flesh. "Take the blood spore," Sean commanded, and the little Ndorobo loped across the clearing. But it was not necessary. The Mau Mau lay where he had dropped. The bullet had ploughed through bamboo, leaf and stem, without being deflected an inch from its track. Ray and Alistair came into the camp, weapons ready, and picked over the bodies. One of the other Mau Mau women was still breathing, though bloody bubbles seethed on her lips, and Ray shot her in the temple with the Sten. "Make sure none of them got away," Sean ordered Matatu in Swahili. The little Ndorobo made a quick circuit of the encampment to check for outgoing spoor, and then came back grinning. "All here," he gloated. "All dead." Sean tossed the Gibbs to him and drew the ivory-handled hunting knife from the sheath on his belt. "Damn it, laddie," Ray Harris protested, as Sean walked back to where the body of the first girl lay. "You are the bloody end, man." He had seen Sean do this before, and although Ray Harris was a hard, callous man who for 30 years had made his living out of blood and gunfire, still he gagged as Sean squatted over the corpse and stropped the blade on the palm of his hand. "You're getting soft, old man," Sean grinned at him. "You know they make beautiful tobacco pouches," he said, and took the dead girl's breast in his hand, pulling the skin taut for the stroke of the knife blade.